Those are the news headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, February 14th, 2025. And we are also in the middle of WPFW's Winter Pledge Drive, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective at this hour by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Because today on the show, we put the spotlight on former President Jimmy Carter's Latin American foreign policy and how it has left a dark cloud over the region despite the whitewashing of his legacy in corporate media. The former Democratic president passed away on December 29th, and in the days immediately after his passing, there was a lot of romanticized curation of his legacy, especially with regards to his foreign policy. Jimmy Carter's legacy in Latin America has been described as mixed for a variety of reasons. However, in spite of his philanthropy and critical acclaim he has received in the years after he left office, our guest today will demonstrate that there is not enough window dressing in the world that could wipe away the truth that a lot of his foreign policy decisions led to the deaths of thousands of people in Latin America alone. And so we are joined today at this Plate Drive Hour with Jorge Cuellar, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. He joins us once again. Welcome back to the show, Jorge Cuellar.
Hey, Oscar, man. Thank you for having me back on the show, man. And I appreciate your patience with me in these last couple of weeks. I've been chomping at the bit to talk about Jimmy Carter, man, because his impact on Central America and in the Caribbean specifically as a result of his foreign policy has left, like you said, a lasting impact in what we know about the region and how the region developed from the 70s to the present.
And during the course of this Place Drive episode today, people are going to realize why a conversation like this lends itself to the importance of supporting independent media outlets like WPFW. So let me begin by conceding that to focus on Jimmy Carter's foreign policy in Latin America alone doesn't tell the whole story. There are stories like the genocide in Cambodia and East Timor that also deserve our attention. His cabinet was filled with architects of the Vietnam War. His disregard for Palestinian lives sound eerily familiar in recent times. The list goes on and on. But let's begin by discussing El Salvador. And for that, I want to quote an article from NPR by Salvadoran American writer Jasmine Romero, who stated the following, quote, "Let's take a stroll through history. It's early January, and we're a few weeks away from the inauguration of a new Republican president following a single-term Democrat who has been criticized for providing an extraordinary amount of military and financial aid to a foreign government accused of human rights violations." Sound familiar? No, I'm not talking about President Biden and his administration's support of Israel. It's January 1981. President Jimmy Carter is on his way out, and the foreign government his administration is supporting is El Salvador's, end quote. So, you and me as Salvadorans, let's start there. How do we begin to summarize Jimmy Carter's legacy regarding El Salvador? Because I think Jasmine Romero hit the nail on the head in her NPR article, and it's something that corporate media completely ignored and whitewashed altogether when Jimmy Carter passed away in late December.
Yeah, man. So Jimmy Carter's relationship to El Salvador is at this point in U.S. history, one where he's attempting to have a sort of human rights focus on U.S. foreign policy. So one of his things is that he doesn't want to be an imperial president like Nixon before him, right? He doesn't want to be this kind of president that imposes U.S. foreign policy on the unsuspecting peoples of Latin America. But his role in El Salvador, and in fact, you know, one could give Jimmy Carter the credit of helping spark the Salvadoran Civil War, he attempts to be a president that castigates the Salvadoran military that at this point has such an overinflated and arrogant sort of disposition. He tries to say, you guys have committed so many human rights in the last few years, we're going to cut funding to you guys. But in the end, what happens is that this, of course, doesn't actually happen, right? He actually supports this 1977 coup d'etat against this guy named Humberto Romero that leads to a military junta, a reformist junta that has some civilians, a progressive guy and military people. And this has Jimmy Carter's blessing. But what happens, though, right, there's a sense that this new moment after 1979, when this coup happens in El Salvador, that things are going to change, right? That reform will come to El Salvador, that the military will curb its repression, right, of opposition groups and of popular organizing, right? And Carter sort of sold this fiction by the Salvadoran government, but instead they go in the same direction that they have always been, right? This is that period of how, like, there's a fear, right, that El Salvador will be another Nicaragua, right? Just in 1979, the Sandinistas are victorious over the Somoza regime, no? And so there's a fear that El Salvador will be the next one to sort of fall. And Reagan will later take this to a whole nother level, right, with the sort of domino theory, right, and the sort of El Salvador is the line in the sand, right? The communists are going to die here. For Carter, however, he was sort of tentative. No, he saw that there was a possibility. He still had a sort of naive approach to El Salvador, where he felt that this new reformist junta would be effective in preventing something like a Salvadoran civil war. But in fact, it went quite the opposite. Carter would continue to fund the military apparatus in El Salvador that was sort of on the upswing in terms of its repression, suppression, clandestine torture centers, disappearance of people, right? This is the legacy that Carter leaves in El Salvador. And in fact, you know, if I also may read from something that was happening in this moment, in February 17 of 1980, Archbishop Oscar Romero, who would be assassinated, a month after this letter is written, he addresses Jimmy Carter by saying, I'm going to read the letter because I think it's actually quite important that your listeners hear this, because this is the kind of historical document and primary source, right? A letter from Archbishop Oscar Romero that was swept under the rug, that was never discussed publicly, and seems like Carter never responded to this, right? And soon thereafter, Romero would be dead. So Oscar Romero says, "Dear Mr. President," addressing Jimmy Carter, "in the last few days, news has appeared in the national press that worries me greatly. According to the reports, your government is studying the possibility of economic and military support and assistance to the present government junta. Because you are a Christian and because you have shown that you defend human rights, I venture to set forth for you my pastoral point of view concerning this news and to make a specific request of you. I am very concerned by the news that the government of the United States is planning to further El Salvador's arms race by sending military equipment and advisors to train 3 Salvadorian battalions in logistics, communication, and intelligence. If this information from the papers is correct, instead of promoting greater justice and peace in El Salvador, your government's contribution will undoubtedly sharpen the injustice and repression inflicted on the organized people, whose struggle has often been for respect for their most basic human rights. The present government junta, and especially the armed forces and security forces, unfortunately have not demonstrated their capacity to resolve in practice the nation's serious political and structural problems. For the most part, they have resorted to repressive violence, producing a total of deaths and injuries much greater than under the previous military regime, whose systematic violation of human rights was denounced by the Inter-American Committee on Human Rights. The brutal form in which the security forces recently evicted and murdered the occupiers of the headquarters of the Christian Democratic Party, even though the junta and the party apparently did not authorize the operation, is an indication that the junta and the Christian Democrats did not govern the country, but that political power is in the hands of unscrupulous military officers who only know how to repress the people and promote the interests of the Salvadoran oligarchy." This goes on, and I'll continue to read, but what Oscar Romero is getting at is, in fact, the hypocrisy of the Jimmy Carter administration and its relationship to El Salvador. He's sending money to bolster the repressive apparatus that is the Salvadoran military, this arrogant entity. No, he also points out the fact that already Jimmy Carter is giving money, right, to launch these battalions that will be the Belloso Battalion and the Atlacat Battalion, that would be the military units that engage in the most bloody of massacres of the forthcoming Salvadoran Civil War. So for this reason, given that as a Salvadoran and as Archbishop of the Archdiocese of San Salvador, I have an obligation to see that faith and justice reign in my country. I ask you, Jimmy Carter, if you truly want to defend human rights, to prohibit the giving of this military aid to the Salvadoran government and guarantee that your government will not intervene directly or indirectly with military, economic, diplomatic, or other pressures to determine the destiny of the Salvadoran people. In these moments, we are living through a grave economic and political crisis in our country, but it is certain that it is increasingly the people who are awakening and organizing and have begun to prepare themselves to manage and be responsible for the future of El Salvador, as only they are capable of overcoming the crisis. It would be unjust and deplorable if the intrusion of foreign powers were to frustrate the Salvadoran people, or to repress them and block their autonomous decisions about the economic and political path that our country ought to follow. It would violate a right which we Latin American bishops, meeting in Puebla, recently recognized when we said, "The legitimate self-determination of our people that permits them to organize according to their own genius and the march of their history and to cooperate in a new international order. I hope that your religious sentiments or your feelings for the defense of human rights will move you to accept my petition, avoiding by this action worse bloodshed in this suffering country. Sincerely, Oscar A. Romero, Archbishop." This letter that is a powerful document of not only Monsignor Romero's sort of ethical vision for El Salvador, but it really points out, right, exactly what Carter's administration was doing, right, and the sort of logic by which his administration was following the template set up by the United States and Central America in the decades prior. So Carter isn't this tectonic shift, right, in American foreign policy towards countries like El Salvador, but in fact was doing the exact same kinds of things, funding repression, right, with a kinder humanitarian face. So when Archbishop Romero is assassinated in March 1980, right, this was a blow to the stability of El Salvador. And some people actually periodize the Salvadoran Civil War from 1980 to 1992, when in fact it's in 79 with this coup that I mentioned. But the Carter administration continued its support, right, for that very junta that of which, like, permitted right, figures like Roberto Dabuson that we've talked before, right, to give orders and to work within this political environment to mobilize death squads to assassinate political opponents and voices of progressivism, right? And like Oscar Romero, you know, Carter's administration and this policy of engaging El Salvador continued throughout his administration. And he really set the stage for the conflict that would then escalate under the Reagan administration. And yeah, I mean, this is complex stuff, right? This isn't a Cold War. There are many things happening that are outside of the control of the United States, right? The Salvadoran military has its own sort of agenda, right? And its own sort of objectives. And so they're mobilized in ways that are sometimes outside of the norms that the United States attempts to put in place with Carter's leadership. But Carter looks the other way when they exceed those limits, right? He doesn't do anything to reprimand the Salvadoran military and this repressive apparatus. You know, he does absolutely nothing. So this sort of balancing of human rights that he's known for was really a kind of sort of performance of a balancing act, because in the end, Carter's approach to El Salvador actually, you know, led to the explosion of what would become the internal armed conflict that, you know, would leave over 70,000 people dead by 1990.
Obviously, we can't, you know, put in the entire story of Jimmy Carter's legacy in a place like El Salvador in just a 1-hour show or even like a 12-15 minute soundbite, but it does lend itself to what Jasmine Romero in her article in NPR that I mentioned at the beginning of how Jimmy Carter's legacy almost parallels Joe Biden's legacy as far as this reckless, dangerous, passive acquiescence of a foreign policy that has led to the deaths of thousands of people. Not only did she compare Joe Biden to Jimmy Carter, she compared El Salvador to Palestine as well. And I don't think that's very off the mark as well in terms of, yes, Ronald Reagan gets a lot of credit for the death and destruction that we saw in the 80s that led to the Salvadoran diaspora that we see here in the U.S. today. But we could also pin the blame, obviously, as we had this conversation, on Jimmy Carter as well. So, for example, there is a memorial in El Salvador that's similar to that of like the Vietnam War memorial in that it's a wall with the names of the victims of people who died during the Civil War. But the timeline isn't from 1980 to 1992. It stretches all the way back to 1976 to 92. And so that includes the Carter administration. And it just gives you an idea of how, yes, Salvadoran migration, you know, accelerated exponentially during the Reagan administration, but the seeds that created the Salvadoran community here in the U.S. today started in the mid-70s during the Carter administration. And again, I want to stress this again, since we are in the middle of a place drive, these are sort of the things that was whitewashed in corporate media when Jimmy Carter passed away. There are over 2 million people of Salvadoran descent in this country, such as myself and my guest Jorge Cuellar, but you won't find them on CNN or MSNBC last month discussing these issues at all whatsoever. And this lends itself to the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW. And this is why we encourage everyone to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation to the Latino Media Collective and to WPFW. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, you can make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, so we can continue having nuanced conversations like this about the legacy of Jimmy Carter's Latin American foreign policy with fantastic guests like Jorge Cuellar. Now let's turn our attention to Nicaragua. And to do that, I have a clip from Under the Shadow, which is hosted by Michael Fox. He wasn't able to join us today, but he had a clip on the Carter administration's response to the burgeoning Sandinista revolution that you sort of mentioned in passing with regards to Nicaragua. So let's take a listen.
As long as I am president, the government of the United States will continue throughout the world to enhance human rights.
Even President Jimmy Carter, he's remembered for his strong stance for human rights. He cut aid from Somoza during the last year of his rule. Carter re-upped it when the FSLN took power. But by early 1980, he'd also authorized the CIA to begin to support unarmed counter-revolutionary forces in Nicaragua.
Because they recognize that there are similar conditions throughout Central America, right? A small oligarchy, big landed elite, and a lot of disaffected civil societies. And you have the emergence of something like liberation theology that can kind of serve as a as an organizing and ideological framework for disparate social elements.
Transmite Radio Venceremos.
Remember, at this time, guerrillas are waging insurgencies against authoritarian U.S.-backed governments in both Guatemala and El Salvador, as we've looked at extensively in this series.
So that was a clip from Under the Shadows Nicaragua episode, which is hosted by Michael Fox, who's a favorite here to show, a frequent guest, I would say. And this clip is illuminating because while we rightfully associate the crimes committed by the Contras to Ronald Reagan, much like El Salvador, it was Carter's administration that sort of set the stage for the tragic chain of events in the 1980s. So I want to know, Jorge, if you could sort of give us a little bit further context of this time period in Nicaraguan history, and of course, Carter's responsibility for what would happen later in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, the clip does a really great kind of way of synthesizing that like transition from Carter's administration and at the same time, the fall of the Somoza regime, where the Carter administration pulls funding for the Somozas and then actually moves some of that support to the inevitable victory of the Sandinistas. And for a long time, at the beginning at least, the Carter administration was really reluctant to like recognize the legitimacy of the Sandinista victory. But eventually, once that became inevitable, right, and through the diplomacy of the Sandinistas internationally, they were able to get the recognition for this new legitimate government, right? The Carter administration tried to use what the United States has often done in Latin America, use cash to buy favors, right? And what I mean by that is that the United States used many of its economic support at that time to they gave it to the Sandinistas in order to impact and influence Sandinista policy, right? In order to mold that nascent embryonic Sandinista project, right? To align with interests of the United States, right? This is sort of U.S. soft power, let's call it that, you know? But this was short-lived, right? At the same time that this was happening, this sort of, let's say, symbolic support of the Sandinistas, right? The Carter administration also began funding, like the clip mentioned, right? These quote-unquote democratic elements within Nicaraguan society that was political opposition, right? But that was also the Contras. And the Contras were a counter-revolutionary force, right, that is often attributed to the Reagan administration. But these initial kind of incipient groups began in the early 1980s and were funded by the Carter administration vis-a-vis the CIA. And this kind of financial assistance for the opposition was as part of a two-pronged approach by the Carter administration to destabilize that Sandinista government at its very beginnings, right? First of all, giving this kind of U.S. support, right, to the Sandinistas by giving them money to foster friendly relations with the idea that the Sandinistas would pursue a more U.S.-style and U.S.-friendly democratic and sort of pro-Western kind of government. And on the other side, that other part is this destabilization campaign, right, that would come through the CIA and the Contras. And what they tried to do is, again, delegitimize the FSLN government, fund disaffected groups from, for example, the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, but also people on the sort of edges of Managua that were disaffected, to be more vocal against the FSLN government in order to discredit it right from the very beginning, to create this perception that the Nicaraguan Sandinistas were not a legitimate government in Nicaragua, right? And so this sort of two-pronged approach was part of Carter's attempt, right, to stave off criticism from Republicans in the United States from losing Nicaragua to communism, right? That the whole idea was that if Nicaragua became Sandinista, it would be another Cuba, right? It would be another Cuba. And so this sort of failure to prevent Nicaragua from going towards Sandinismo and towards Nicaraguan socialism, right, became a sort of thorn in the side of the Carter administration in the elections that would come in later 1980, right, with eventually Reagan winning that election. But really this sort of weird friendly persuasion with U.S. funds, right, at the same time that they're funding these counter-revolutionary CIA groups is kind of that two-facedness, right, of how U.S. foreign policy has always operated in Central America. And in that kind of way, right, Carter didn't deviate from that template. It's still that same approach, right, where they're helping you with one hand, but they're trying to undercut you with the other. And this kind of sort of hypocrisy was something that Carter didn't change. In fact, he deepened some of this, and it became sort of an approach that would then become more extreme in a lot of ways under Reagan.
Yeah, and again, I want to reiterate this, but going back to what we said at the beginning, what is the difference here between the Biden administration and the Carter administration in regards to this passive acquiescence, as you just described now, with regards to Nicaragua and El Salvador? I mean, the idea that losing Nicaragua, as if Nicaragua belonged to the United States to begin with, is perverse in and of itself. And it just boils my blood sometimes when I hear that, because there are a lot of people in corporate media and in government who don't recognize U.S. imperialism even when it comes out of their mouths. And it's sort of astounding, even as we have this conversation today, even as we look at what we've discussed so far with what's happening with recent events. And it's so astounding how, you know, I have to say this, since we're in the middle of a place drive here, that I started out here at WPFW as a college intern back in 2003, right around the same time as the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And to see corporate media almost 22 years later, I'm old, I know, but to see corporate media 22 years later still get everything wrong with regards to the facts and the realities of the ground, whether we're talking about Gaza or the ridiculous story about the Panama Canal and everything in between in the last month alone with this new Trump administration, just astounds me. I encourage everyone who's listening to us to go back to the Pacifica Radio archives around 2003 and see how independent media outlets like WPFW got everything right with regards to giving a spotlight to either grassroots resistance or to historians and academics and fantastic voices like Jorge Cuellar, and compare that to everything that corporate media got wrong from the U.S. invasion of Iraq right up until today. And it's sort of astounding how corporate media can't recognize U.S. imperialism when it's staring them in the face, let alone even acknowledge it, say it out loud. And this is why it's so important to support independent media outlets like WPFW and programs like the Latino Media Collective, so we can continue to have fantastic guests like Jorge Cuellar, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, on the show to give us a more nuanced understanding of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy legacy in Latin America and why it's still relevant to what we see today in recent times. So again, go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. Our goal at this hour is $500. You can also go to the Cash App if you have it on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Clash, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, reminding everyone that we are in the middle of WPFW's winter plates drive. So we encourage everyone to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So we could continue to have fantastic guests like the one we have today, Jorge Cuello, who's an assistant professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. We're talking about Jimmy Carter's legacy, foreign policy legacy in Latin America. And Jorge, since we are in the middle of a pledge drive, I want to talk to you about the Panama Canal, because the treaty between Panama and the U.S. was done during Jimmy Carter's legacy. And at any other point, this would be a rather benign story to talk about until Donald Trump decided to say, hey, we want to take the Panama Canal back from Panama. And he's giving a variety of all sorts of absurd and ridiculous and I would say rather racist motivations as to why he wants to take the Panama Canal back from Panama. But again, like I said before the break, it's imperialism staring us in the face. And it happened during the Carter administration, the Panama Canal Treaty with Omar Torrijos, if I'm not mistaken. And that's a complicated story in and of itself. We do intend to do a show separately on the nuanced legacy of Omar Torrijos, but that's for another time. But what do you make of both the Panama Canal Treaty and how it's somehow, you know, made its way back in the headlines incredibly?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. I've been talking to my students quite a bit about the Panama Canal. And like, I mean, I teach a Central America class and we often have to talk about the Panama Canal because it's so important to the story of Central America, but not in this kind of way, right? Where sort of the repo man, also known as Donald Trump, is here to take back the canal, right? As if it belongs to them. It's kind of like lost imperial possession, you know? It's been an interesting conversation to break that down with the students. And often the way that I tell the story of the way the Panama Canal returns to Panamanian hands is actually from the 1960s, so a little bit before Carter, but these 1964 flag riots, or what in Panama is called El Día de los Mártires, the Day of the Martyrs, because it's in this moment where Panamanian nationalists, students actually, high school students from a high school called Balboa High School, attempt to plant a U.S. flag in the canal zone, this 50-mile strip of land that is controlled by the United States, and that is an enduring symbol, right, of U.S. imperialism and colonialism, modern-day colonialism. It represents the hegemony of the United States in Central America, right? Right at the heart of the entirety of Latin America, which has a kind of symbolic power. But what I mean to say about these flag riots is that this is really the origin point of the long struggle of Panamanian people, of ordinary Panamanians, right? That struggled for the return of the canal zone to Panamanian hands. We often focus on the treaty, right, with Torrijos and Carter, which is valuable and important, and it does seal the fate of this process, yeah, right? But it really is motivated, right, by the yearnings of Panamanian people that saw that, you know, sort of monument to U.S. colonialism could no longer hold. I mean, like, it was the incredible inequalities of Panama, the actual country, with this canal zone that belonged to the United States and had its sort of representatives in the House of Representatives that lived a kind of white lifestyle within Panama, where U.S. dollars circulated, right, rather than Panamanian currency, right? This thing that was like just so really kind of an emblem to a form of segregation, right? This was a place that had for a long time Jim Crow laws, right, within the canal zone, where, you know, whites only spaces, right, where Panamanian, primarily Black Panamanian labor was a second class, right, and could actually not live within the zone. They had to live in places outside of it, such as El Chorrillo and all these neighborhoods outside of it.
You know what? As you say this, we mentioned earlier the comparison between Palestine and El Salvador.
It's apartheid.
As you're describing this, the segregation you're referring to in Panama sounds a lot like a comparison to Gaza as well.
Exactly. It's literally apartheid. This is what this is, though. This is an occupation by the U.S. military that have control over the waterway, right, the Panama Canal. But this is for many Panamanians, right, that are mobilized against this, right? This generates a kind of deep-seated resentment, right, over the U.S. control of the Panama Canal zone, the unequal treatment of Panamanian people, right, this kind of second-class citizenship that I mentioned, right? And as well, the fact that the U.S. would not permit, right, And this is the arrogance of U.S. empire. The U.S. would not permit that Panamanians fly the flag within the zone, right? And so that little sort of what appears to be a sort of regular disagreement, right, became enough, right, for Panamanians to begin to assert the right to that territory. And the fact that this actually is Panama, this is not the United States, right? This sort of, you know, monument to segregated imperial living, right, that the zone represented must go. And this began in the 1960s. And so you can imagine, like, over the decades, right, once we get to Jimmy Carter in the late 70s, you already have a very strong nationalist sentiment, an anti-American sentiment, right, against the zone and against the Panama Canal under U.S. control, right? All the profits, right, that was generating was going elsewhere, was going to the United States, was going to the U.S. Treasury. It wasn't going to Panamanian people. It wasn't elevating the standard of living of Panamanians, right? It was going elsewhere. It was subsidizing, you know, the sort of tropical lifestyles of white Americans in Panama City, right? It wasn't doing anything for Panamanian people. And this is where you get to then, like, the administration of Omar Torrijos, right? And this incredible push, right, for the treaties, right, that would be worked out in the 1970s, right? And it would end, right? It would finally end over 90 years of U.S. control over the Panama Canal Zone and would finally return that canal and that territory to Panama. And so now when you have somebody like Trump very kind of glibly saying we need to take back the canal, it really goes to the heart, right, of Panamanian identity and Panamanian nationalism and the struggle for sovereignty and the sort of rejection of a U.S. imperialism, right? It's bigger than hip-hop, basically, right? It's not just about this thing called the Panama Canal, but it represents an entire imaginary of a people, right? Where their nationalism itself was produced, right, through the struggle, right, to recover this territory that was sold off, basically, right, in the early 20th century.
It's the free movement of capital undermining democracy. And you sort of hit the nail on the head right there, because whether we're talking about the Panama Canal, which generates millions of dollars in revenue, or a Pizza Hut or a McDonald's setting up shop in El Salvador, the only way those American companies can make money, can turn a profit, is for that money that's generated day to day, leave the country altogether. And when that money leaves a country like a place like Panama or El Salvador, that money is not going back to the people. It's not going back to the country. That's capitalism. That's American capitalism right there. And there's no ambiguity as a result with Trump's statements about retaking the Panama Canal. It's all about money and a little racism on the side along the way. But again, corporate media is still just, I'm sorry, but it still gets under my skin that they are not acknowledging these sort of things. But we are acknowledging it in independent media outlets like WPFW. And this is why we have guests like Jorge Cuellar. Where else would you have a Salvadoran American host talking to a Salvadoran American guest about the other side of Jimmy Carter's foreign policy legacy outside of the whitewashing that we saw in corporate media in early January? But to have voices like Jorge on the show, we need your support. We need the audience, the WPFW audience, to support outlets like the Latino Media Collective at this hour by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, go to $WPFWFM, make a donation there. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, because we've only hit the tip of the iceberg here when it comes to Jimmy Carter's legacy in Latin America. We can easily talk about the fact that he was just as acquiescent with the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile around the same time. Was he supportive or passive with regards to the Videla dictatorship in Argentina? Probably so. There are many other countries in Latin America and the Caribbean that deserve our attention when it comes to Jimmy Carter's time in office. But what we ended up getting instead, Jorge, was this sort of romanticized vision or image of Carter's legacy in CNN, on MSNBC, on Fox News, and all these other sort of outlets. And I'm sure it gets under your skin just as much as it does mine. And we even haven't even mentioned, you know, the issue of how Haitians were treated during that time, Guantanamo Bay is back in the news again with regards to the detention of migrants. The Mario boat lift as well happened during that time during Carter's administration. I have to say that there's this fantastic article in Counterpunch by Michael K. Smith that completely eviscerates Jimmy Carter's legacy. And it's not that often that I'll put an article on our Twitter account from a guest that's not been on the show with us, but I will put that on there because he destroys them in a number of ways, not only to foreign policy, but also when it comes to labor rights, when it comes to giving gifts to corporate interests as well. Again, so many parallels between the Biden administration and the Jimmy Carter administration. And so, Jorge, I want to ask you, you know, like I said before, there's so many other countries in Latin America with regards to his foreign policy that deserve our attention. Are there any others that you want to point out? And what do you make of the whitewashing that you saw last month, you know, in the days following his passing? Because I'm sure as a historian, you were just looking at it like, hey, you guys are missing so much. Either you're ignorant to it or you are purposely whitewashing the reality of his legacy.
Yeah, man. I mean, what I saw in the media was a lot of Jimmy Carter worship. You know, it was all about his post-presidency rather than his presidency. You know, Habitat for Humanity, building some houses in Africa. You know, this is what he's sort of known for. These are the images that remain with a lot of the media and the sort of history that you and I have been talking about, right? The sort of political moment where Carter is an agent of the empire, you know, we forgot that part. And, you know, like, I think sort of keeping it to Central America, I think at this moment is probably better. I think there's another sort of Carter's Caribbean crusades, you know, that we could do too. You mentioned Chile and Argentina as well. But one thing that I want to say, returning to the Panama Canal really quickly, is that we can't discount also what figures like Omar Torrijos, then president of Panama, was doing in order to pressure Carter into these treaties, right? The treaties are in 1977 with the idea that the canal would return to Panamanian hands in December 31st, 1999. But Torrijos is being also sort of a diplomat, right? He's touring Europe. He's going through Latin America. He's having diplomatic meetings with all sorts of people in order to convince, right, and pressure the United States and pressure the Carter administration specifically to enter into good faith negotiations, right, to end the U.S. occupation. So American colonialism or American imperialism didn't just go away in Panama because of the goodwill of its president, you know, Jimmy Carter. But no, Latin American diplomacy and Panamanian diplomacy through Torrijos put the pressure on them, right, that they could no longer sustain this like egregious effort, you know, of military occupation and control of the Panama Canal. And so I think that's also part of this story, right, that we need to remember that the U.S. is also not just unilaterally sort of enforcing some different things in Latin America. There's movements against the United States, right, that are interpreting and reacting to U.S. foreign policy in ways that oftentimes, right, lead to these important outcomes for those countries that there are falsely attributed to, you know, the goodness and the kind-heartedness and the human rights-centric foreign policy of Jimmy Carter, when in fact, right, Jimmy Carter's arm was being twisted, right, by Latin American leaders like Omar Torrijos, by, you know, the Sandinistas and the FSLN, by Cuba, by other Latin American leaders, right, that were pushing for the end of these, like, legacy occupations that, you know, have been there for a long time. One of the things that happens in Panama, right, after the treaties are signed, is also the U.S. military demobilizing in Panama. So alongside the canal, you had the U.S. military. This is where the U.S. Southern Command is located, right? Panama is central strategically for all the U.S. military presence and interventions that would happen in South America, you know, from Paraguay to Brazil, you know, up to Colombia and northward into Guatemala. Like, a lot of it was coming from the U.S. Southern Command in Grenada, right? Of course, all from that place in Panama. So the demobilization of the U.S. military as a result of the Carter-Torrijos treaties are important for that, too. They're important not only for Panama, they're important for Latin America, because it begins, right, the scaling down of U.S. military presence in the sort of belly button, right, of the Americas. So this is really crucial to remember, right, that Carter's moving in a sort of geopolitical moment, right, where leadership in Latin America also looks much different, right? Unlike now, where you have figures like, you know, Mulino, current president of Panama, again, kowtowing to the United States, right?
Yeah.
And kowtowing to the pressures of Marco Rubio and Donald Trump. It's a different geopolitical moment where all this stuff that we're talking about almost feels like we see it through sort of rose-colored glasses, right? Where it can look like, oh, a better situation where, you know, politics could be maneuvered and diplomacy worked very differently. Unlike today, where it's all very tit for tat, no? And Trump and Rubio can go to Latin America with this like absurd idea of retaking the Panama Canal, when really what is happening is that they're looking for harsher and more strict migration controls, right, at the Darien Gap.
Precisely. And thank you for mentioning the Darien Gap as well, because with the support of the WPFW audience in the coming weeks and months ahead, we are intending to do a show on Omar Torrijos, the former president of Panama, because he's a very nuanced, complicated character. There's some aspects of his legacy where we could easily describe him as a dictator, but if you ask Afro-Panamanians, they might tell you something different. It's very complicated, it's very nuanced, and it sort of breaks the left-right paradigm that limits the frame of debate in this country all too often. We also plan to do a show exclusively on Marco Rubio and how his new post in the Trump administration, you know, is going to complicate things in Latin American politics today. And you mentioned the Darien Gap. That's another show that we intend to do, because the physical consequences have been sort of described numerous times by immigrants who have, you know, experienced going through the Darien Gap, the dangers of that part of Panama, but also the psychological damage that it does to people seeking refuge and migrating to the U.S. as well. But all these fantastic stories that deserve more attention, that deserve a greater spotlight, that deserves a deep dive conversation, is only possible with the support of listeners. Even right now, as we have this conversation, Donald Trump is attacking the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, NPR, PBS, public media outlets. You know, to what degree will that affect WPFW? I don't know. I really don't know. But the only way to combat it is through supporting independent media outlets like WPFW, which is why it is so crucial and so important to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation to support programs like the Latino Media Collective. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, go to $WPFWFM, make a donation, give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, because we want to expand more conversations and bring more fantastic guests like Jorge Cuellar on the show. We have about 2 minutes left, Jorge. I'm glad that you mentioned Guatemala, because much like El Salvador, the deteriorating state of Guatemala in the mid to late 70s, again, much like El Salvador, was because of Carter's passive acquiescence to the military junta there at the time that set the stage for the tragic chain of events that we saw in Guatemala in the 1980s. Chief among them was the Mayan genocide. So in the 2 minutes that we have left, what else do you want to address or point out? What should we learn from this whitewashing of Carter's history in Latin America? Because you mentioned all these things that he did after his presidency. There's not enough of that that could make us ignore the crimes they committed during his presidency.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to always remember that, you know, the sitting in the hot seat, right, which is being president of the United States, is always a sort of fraught position. There's only so much limited maneuverability that any president can make, especially right when they're going to push for something like human rights and things like this. And I think this was the limitations of the Carter administration that often people forget, right? That he existed in a system where the CIA, the State Department, right, the FBI in domestic affairs, right, was doing so many different things that were attacking organized movements, that was attacking student groups, that was against, right, social movements throughout the hemisphere. And so, like, and all of that gets attributed to the Carter administration, because the Carter administration should have been able to sort of control this, right? And so these are complicated. Administrations are very, very complicated. I mean, we see it today with figures like Elon Musk going on this sort of rampage, right, and dismantling everything under the sun and Trump being either none the wiser or sort of neglectful and just letting it happen. And so there's all these, you know, different pieces to all of this. But what we got to understand too is that despite what we want to think about Carter and sort of the mixed legacy, you know, the passive acquiescence, for much of Latin America in this period, and even the Sandinistas will affirm this, Carter did represent an opening, right? Carter represented a sort of difference in U.S. empire in this moment, where the Canal Treaty, where, right, the support that Carter gave, even if it was lip service to human rights, created opportunities, diplomatic opportunities, geopolitical opportunities for Latin America to assert its self-determination, right, in a way that would be impossible just a year after, right, with Reagan's administration and the sort of curtailing and rolling back of all Carter's diplomatic successes, right, you know, tarnishing the Carter administration as being weak, right, as letting Nicaragua go to the communists, as losing the Panama Canal, right, all these kinds of narratives that they would impact the ways that the Carter administration, this really the singularity of it, that like how it was different than things that came before and after, got lost. You know, so we got to remember that part too, despite that administration's incredible errors and the way that it ended up giving continuity to a lot of the United States and the U.S. military's most negative, you know, habits in the hemisphere.
We hope everyone enjoyed this conversation, this nuanced conversation with Jorge Cuellar, but it's only possible with your support to WPFW and to programs like the Latino Media Collective. If you go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation, so we could continue to have fantastic guests like Jorge Cuellar on the show. Once again, Jorge Cuellar is the Assistant Professor of Latin American, Latino, and Caribbean Studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. We're certainly going to continue having more conversations like these, so long as this current Trump administration continues to make open gestures and open proclamations of U.S. imperialism and the Monroe Doctrine in places not only like Panama, but another place in Latin America and the Caribbean as well, because it certainly seems that way with his new administration. So Jorge Cuellar, it's been insightful and enlightening. Thank you very much for being on the show once again.
Thanks again, Oscar. And please donate to WPFW. Keep public broadcasting alive and support my man Oscar in the booth, who's making this incredible space for critical dialogue about U.S. foreign policy in Latin America.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. Once again, make a donation to $WPFWFM. If you have the Cash App on your phone, give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, or go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And you can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And you can follow us on our own website, which is LatinoMediaCollective.com. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or a daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations. And then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW. And it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org. Make the plan. pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
The 2025 Mid-Atlantic Jazz Festival is back, February 14th through the 16th at the Bethesda Marriott, celebrating the theme, Playing the Changes. It features Sharon Clark, Tia Fuller, Oren Evans, Paul Carr, Chelsea Green, Christy Dashiell, Carmen Bradford, Vincent Herring, and more. Performances, jam sessions, and masterclasses all under one roof. Info at midatlanticjazzfestival.org. WPFW, Building a Better World. One broadcast at a time.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, February 14th. Here are some headlines. A federal judge put a temporary injunction on Donald Trump's attempts to dismantle the United States Agency for International Development, USAID. The ruling by Judge Amir H. Ali of the Federal District Court in Washington found that Trump's executive order imposing a blanket freeze on U.S. foreign aid spending was based on dubious logic. He said it was also probably causing irreparable harm to aid groups, which face devastating financial shortfalls and in some cases shutdown if the freeze stays in place. Ali cited the example of one nonprofit that protects refugees and asylum seekers. It reported having to lay off 535 staff members after losing federal grants, shutter program offices, and defer payments to its vendors. Judge Ali was also skeptical about the Trump administration's stated rationale for the freeze, which it says is to allow for a review in part to locate what it claims is hidden wasteful spending. In other news, the acting U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Danielle Sassoon, and at least six federal prosecutors, including two senior officials in Washington, D.C., resigned after refusing to follow a Justice Department order to drop the corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. In a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi, Sassoon said that Adams' attorneys repeatedly indicated that Adams would be in a position to assist with DOJ enforcement priorities only if the indictment were dismissed, and that her office was preparing to file additional charges against Adams. In more news, the Trump administration yesterday intensified its sweeping efforts to shrink the size of the federal workforce, the nation's largest employer, by ordering agencies to lay off nearly all probationary employees who had not yet gained civil service protection, potentially affecting hundreds of thousands of workers. The American Federation of Government Employees president, Everett Kelly, today criticized the reports of a mass layoff of federal workers holding probationary positions. Kelly said employees were given no due process and no prior notice. Kelly, who called the departures firings, said they would eliminate talent that federal agencies would need for years to come. The decision from the Office of Personnel Management is the latest of several efforts by the White House to reduce the federal workforce. And the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas appears to be back on track after Hamas said it will release Israeli hostages this weekend as initially planned. Hamas had postponed the release of more hostages, accusing Israel of violating the truce. In response, Israel warned it would return to fighting. But after talks with key mediators, Egypt and Qatar, Hamas said that the releases, which will see Palestinian prisoners exchanged in return, will go ahead. So far, 16 of 33 Israeli hostages scheduled for release in the current phase of the agreement have been freed by Hamas, and 656 Palestinian prisoners from a list of nearly